Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another evening of Gemara learning. Oh, we should make it into a game show. That'd be fun. So we find ourselves in middle, not middle, on the top of Chavav Amid Aleph, on top of 26A. And myself, I mean, obviously, Old Torah is fascinating and interesting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the disclaimers I have to give beforehand, but I actually found this Amud of Gemara particularly interesting because there's a very strong and obvious halacha lemaisa element to it, a strong practical element. We're going to be primarily dealing with the question of selling a synagogue, how that can be done, what can the funds be used for, what can the building be used for. And in that discussion, we'll talk a little bit about the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, but for the most part, we're going to talk about things that are pretty practical, actually. And
We did that in Bayswater.
okay. So what was the case? Oh, that's right. Young Israel was in a location by the train station, and then
We were in Wavecrest, and we sold the building and bought another building in
it's very, it's
Bayswater.
very, it's that's excellent. And you know, not only in Bayswater, but a good Hashem's history. My understanding is we were on Grove Street or somewhere else beforehand. And the long timers can tell me the who's been in the community for a while. Audrey, I feel like you, Audrey, has it your family?
My son has, but not me. Right.
Oh, okay. All right. We were so our shul went through.
The old building is on Grove Street. Yes. It's still there. It's used as a black church, but it still has the Magen David and everything else on it.
Right, I thought it was like a messianic church at first when I saw the Magen David, but I guess that's our old shul. So
Yes.
that adds
Yes.
another layer to the question
And
of like selling it.
we sold the shul that my parents and my relatives had been instrumental in establishing in the 20s.
Oh,
And
wow.
unfortunately, everything changes, and it was sold. Chabad used it for a while. Then after that, it was sold to a group of artists, Jewish artists. And I don't know what happened after that.
Well, all better than what happened in Fairfield.
Yeah.
There they knocked the shul down. They sold it to a nursing home outfit, and they knocked the shul down, and it's. But they're still holding the proceeds with the hope of maybe starting, buying a new building, whatever, but already this has been 5 years.
Right. So it sounds like many of us, either through Stanford or from our other communities, are kind of familiar with this dynamic. So it's going to be an interesting question. I'm not going to weigh in on the propriety of it for specific examples, but we're going to learn the sugya. I'll share with you some of the mefarshim, and I think we'll have a bit of an appreciation for how the process is supposed to go. So here we go. Just a brief summary of the Mishnah. If we recall in the Mishnah, we learned basically a principle which is very relevant for Chanukah coming up, that we're malim b'kodesh v'lo moridim, that we always have to go up in sanctity or equal to, we can never go less than. So in the case of Chanukah, we start with one candle, we build up to eight. Similarly, over here, if I sell the shul, then the shul can be used to buy an ark. If I sell the ark, it can be used to buy covers for the Torah, but it can't go the opposite direction. So that's a principle that I think is relatively intuitive, but if not, now we know.
But
So
it
here we
kind of
go.
doesn't make sense, Rabbi. If you sold the shul, what do you need an ark for? What do you need, all those different things?
Right. It could be a merger. Imagine you have a merger, right? So one shul's closing down, and now they're going to open up a minyan inside another shul's building.
Something like
I'm
that.
sure we're creative. We could come up with a case, but I mean, those are cases that happen, right? When there's not enough to support two shuls in town. Okay, here we go. If you hear banging, just ignore. Talia's trying to break into the room here. Okay. So the Gemara begins again. We're on the top of 26A, Chafavim and Aleph. That we learned that when members of the city sell the street, the main area, so we said that during the fast days, the Gemara will tell us momentarily, certain fast days, they would actually go out into public to beseech God in the town square. So the idea that there's a some form of kedusha, some form of sanctity to the middle of the city, this is the opinion of Rav Nachman bar Rav Yossi, who basically many times he's kind of, when there's a stam, when there's, we don't know, it's anonymous, we don't know who it is, this is the guy. Because many times in Mishnayos and in Brisos, we know who the second opinion is. The second opinion could be Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda. But many times we have the Tana Kama, the anonymous initial opinion. So we're saying over here, this is the opinion of Rabbi Nachman bar Rav Yossi, who apparently is the anonymous author of many rulings as well. However, there is no sanctity to the street where people gather to pray. So let's understand, what is the basis of this dispute? So the first opinion that says there is some residual sanctity, as we said, Rashi Vilasim, based on this Gemara, since they would go and pray during the Tanios, during the Mamados. Mamados were when Yisraelim, they had shifts to read from the Torah and pray while the Kohanim and Levim were working in the Beis HaMikdash. It wasn't simply that the Kohanim and Levim do their job for us, but we're supposed to pitch in as well. Rabbanan. Okay, so why do the rabbis then think that there's no Kedusha? Aren't we performing ritual acts in the streets? So the answer is, this is a very important principle, Ahu akarai ba'alma. It's true we did some religious acts in the street, but it doesn't render the street sanctified. For instance, if you go to Hershey Park on Chol HaMoed, and you gather together to make an ad hoc minyan on the spot while you're waiting 50 minutes online, it doesn't all of a sudden render that line for Chocolate Mountain, I don't remember, the Reese's Puffs ride, or whatever it is. It's been a long time, actually. I'm actually just waiting online for the kettle corn stand. That's usually me. It doesn't render that area kaddosh. What makes an area kaddosh? So we actually did this in the shiur. If you remember, we got to bring that back, but we had Beit Midrash nights some time back in the major Beit Midrash. So when we had one of those nights, we talked about what makes a base medrash sanctified. And we actually, I believe, quoted this Gemara. It's a machlokas Rashi and Rambam. If you look at Rashi over here on the side, or you can just listen to me, it's only two words. He says, what's it mean? What's the issue with it being akrai? Akrai means not established. Rashi says, eino tadir, because it's not used frequently. Rambam has a different interpretation on this. The Rambam says, what's it mean, eino akrai? It means you didn't designate this place as a place meant for worship. That's a little bit different. According to Rashi, even if we don't intend to sanctify somewhere, if we just use it frequently enough, you know, what's happening actually. I don't think it's actually the case, but it was like a minyan that meets at 6:13 at 1:45 almost every day, a mincha minyan, 1:45 in the afternoon. I one time had to avail myself. I had a funeral at 2 o'clock at the shul. So I went there to daven, you know, quickly 1:45, and then I, you know, zoomed right over for the funeral. So it's a good resource to know about. But they daven in the outside area of 6:13. So, is the fact that they daven there every day all of a sudden render 6:13 with the kedusha of Beis HaTfilah? No, especially based on the Rambam, because it's not about frequency. It's about designation. Are you intentionally designating this place as a makom kadosh, as a holy place? So therefore, you don't have to worry. You're allowed to eat and enjoy yourself when you go to eat at the restaurant. It's not considered a Beis HaKnesses. Okay.
I might also add that you really wouldn't want to dedicate the place of prayer where dogs run loose, where people are running their chariots and their carts.
Mm, fair point. Right, because what's going to, right, exactly. So Zane, what you're saying is just what's going to happen the rest of the year when we're not setting up an ad hoc prayer session. You know what it reminds you of? Zadie, you know this from Bayswater. I don't know if they do it here, but they would set up like, a few blocks from us during the summer, like these tent revival things they have like these big church ceremonies in these tents, and it'd be like all these charismatic speakers that get up and they have their instruments. So they take over that empty lot near Mott Avenue. So that was like their thing that they would do every summer. And then the rest of the year was a barren lot that was never used. So it's a similar situation. Okay, Lahav de Lafayette Bills. Moving on, next section of the Gemara. Beis Hakanesis Lokhin Teva. So, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmini, Rabbi Yochanan. Lo Shana El Beis Hakanesis Shel Kfarm. Ah. So here's what the Gemara is going to qualify for us. In addition to the fact that the funds that are used from a shul that is sold can only be used to buy something holier, there's an additional limitation that you cannot always sell a shul. When can you not? So you're allowed to sell a shul when it's a shul that's in a village. Suburban shuls can be sold. Al beis haknesses shel krachin, but the shuls that you'll find in the city, you go to Manhattan and you have those shuls on Upper East Side, Upper West Side, Lower East Side, wherever. Why can you not sell those? Kevan deme alma osule lo matzu mizavnile tahavale derab. Because the shuls of the city, I mean, honestly, a shul like a good shalom, this may very well apply to as well. These shuls of cities, of major civilized areas, are not being made just for the people who founded the shul. They're being made for the public. They're being made for that commuter who's coming through to catch a mincha. By the way, you look at our minyan at the shul on a typical mincha marav night. A quarter of the men who are present there, I've talked to, and I never see them otherwise because they're commuters who are just, they're coming in from West Hartford or they're coming in from New Haven, and they catch mincha on their way back. So that's why I say our shul may very well be like the shuls of the cities, even though we like to think of ourselves as suburban, because the shuls are not just made for our personal use, but it's made for the use of the public. So how can we go ahead and sell this shul when it's going to be to the detriment of those other people who maybe they will not consent to us selling the shul? Ah, so does someone have a question on that? Because it's a toast. Now, what might bother you about that?
I have something I want to add.
Something bothers me.
In Bayswater, when we sold the shul, we didn't use the money for something of greater kedusha. We used it to buy a house and dedicated that house as a shul before we wound up ultimately building a new building next to it.
Right. So I don't want to weigh in on the specifics. There's an exception to the rule where the funds could be used even for non-religious purposes. It's only at the end of the Gemara. So God willing, we'll address that case, but not that case specifically, because I don't want to weigh in and get into politics. Toby, yes, what bothers you?
What bothers me about this is it should be exactly pumfa carrot, because in an urban setting, you'll have a few shuls. So if one of them gets sold, there's other shuls people can go to. In a rural setting, chances are there's only one shul for miles and miles around. And if that gets sold, what are the people going to do?
Oh, okay. I thought something else bothered you, but this is a good point also. Okay, I may have given the wrong framework. A kfar is actually a village. Remember we talked about when to lay Megillah? So we had the kfar, yeah, which were the villages. So yeah, suburban is actually the wrong term. What it's really contrasting is like what you said, rural versus metropolis. It doesn't really talk about suburban. Like I think there'd be a difference between, like, let's say a good shalom versus the young Israel here. A good shalom, I don't daven mincha at the young Israel. My sense is when people are kind of looking for a minion to catch on their way home through Stamford, they generally stop at a good shalom. That's my sense. But anyway, I think you're right, Toby. You go to some shul out there in like Omaha, Nebraska, where I could be wrong. I think there's only one Orthodox shul there. Who knows?
No, there's more than one. There's a Chabad.
Well, yeah, there's always a Chabad in addition.
Right, right. But I'm saying, as opposed to,
Yeah.
Fairfield, Connecticut, as opposed to Manhattan,
Yes, I accept your framework. I think that makes sense. Now, another question that actually was bothering me a little bit, and Tosos addresses that, is, wait a minute. It's all well and good that we open up our shul and that we welcome in people who are visiting. We welcome people who are just dropping by for a minyan, and we serve as a resource for them. That's beautiful. But at the end of the day, who should be the one rendering the decision for the shul? Who should we be looking out for? Arguably, one could say we should be looking out for the people who are actual members of the community, and their needs should supersede the needs of someone who occasionally uses the shul, right? Does it sound like a legitimate question? I think it's a legitimate question. Tosos is going to tell us otherwise, though. So you look at Tosos on the top left. You're well, there is, by the way, Art Scrolls working on translating Tosos now. I don't know if they did Megill yet. I know they did Brachos, but you can follow along inside if you'd like. It's only going to be in Aramaic/Hebrew. So here we go. First Tosos on the top. Kevan deva alma kaasule near the farish. Hafi kevan dershirov bnei other magim aleches sham lispalel. Since many people come to make use of this shul, av al pisha ein nosim klum bebinyano, even though they didn't contribute to the capital campaign, mikol makom kevan de ladas osan rab nasa chamur kishasov ein yichol mochrom. Nonetheless, since the shul is intentionally established as a community shul for the purpose of the rabbim, even if you didn't contribute to the building, literally to the building of the shul, it's still being established with the intention of serving beyond the people who are kind enough to make it happen. That's one opinion in Tosos. The other opinion in Tosos, it's a little bit closer to what my intuition was. Obviously, my intuition doesn't matter. What Tosa tells us what matters. The next one. The other opinion is Va'odi Isha Farish, Kevin Shir Rabin Nosim Yana Ushar Tsrachav. This is a little bit different. If you don't contribute to the shul, then your opinion actually doesn't matter when it comes to these things. But the thing is, how it happens often enough that someone passes through our shul. They came for a yard side, or they just, you know, pass by and appreciate that we provide a resource for them. So they'll come and say, can I give a check to the shul out of appreciation and gratitude for providing a minyan? So that individual, he may not be a member of the community. He may have not helped actually build the shul, but once he actually makes a contribution to the shul, now his opinion matters when we're going to sell the shul. Therefore, it's very difficult. The Gemara is telling us, there's going to be an exception only at the end. The Gemara is telling us that we can't just sell a major shul that's used for the community, because how are you going to track down all these people that pass through for Mincha and Maariv on weekdays and make sure that each and every one of them signs off to it? That's virtually impossible. It's like that story with Lashon Hara and he spreads the feathers everywhere. Now go try to collect them. You know, it's kind of like that. Okay, very good. Let's go back to the Gemara now. We're at Amar Rav Ashi. This is a story that is going to be in line with it, but an exception. Amar Rav Ashi. Hai bein k'nishim t'masim nechasiya avagat me'ama asula kim da daiti di di ka'asu iba ina mezivina. So here's an exception to the rule. There's a difference between a good shalom kind of shul, and this is more like, think of it, again, I'm being a little bit anachronistic, but just to help give us some sort of framework, this is like a shtiebel. So if you're going like a shtiebel, there's like the rav of the shul. The shtiebel can actually be his house, like the shul's on the first level, and his family lives up on the second level. My father's father, I remember when we would daven with him in Farakaway, I don't remember the name of the shul, but that was the situation at the shtiebel he liked to daven at. So there, even though people actually do, Tosa says, even though people actually do contribute to the shul, where's the money meant to go? The way it works in the shtiebel, it's like a benevolent dictatorship, right? So like, you know, there's no, say it's a rabbi's paradise. There's no board telling the rabbi what to do. The rabbi, it's just the rabbi's place and that's it. So where does the money go? It doesn't go to some general fund. It goes to, I actually don't know the inner workings of how these operations go, but I guess it goes more or less to his discretionary fund, and then he decides what to do with it. So there, since the shul of Rav Ashi was like his shtiebel, it could have been a very big shtiebel for all we know, and the shul was kind of made by people who wanted to gather around him, he was the sole arbiter of what to do with the shul. You know what's a good example of it? What's that place in Woodmere? The Neo-Hasidic place, Ish Kodesh. I don't know if it operates like that, but it's a similar idea where the shul was kind of like, if I understand correctly, was like built around the rabbi. Like people wanted this rabbi and they all come, at least that's nowadays how it works. We should all be so lucky. Okay, moving on. So we are going to give two challenges now to this principle. Again, so the principle is that city shuls cannot be sold because you're not going to get there's no way to get the consent of everyone, of the entire public. So we're gonna give two challenges to that position. Number one, Mesve. All right, Yehuda, Mites and Bisa Knesses, Shel Torsiam. What are Torsiam? If you look at Rashi, Rashi says, Sorfei Nechoshes. These are people who purify and process copper. So again, I'm not really sure why. I'm sure someone with a better historical background could explain this. There'd be shuls and people, you know, some nowadays you go to a shul because maybe it's Nesach Ashkenaz or Nesach Sfard, or maybe because it has youth programming, or because it has a really good kiddush, or that I don't go because that one doesn't have a kiddush that I like, or whatever. So back in the day, they split up based on professions. So the copper people would go to one shul, those blacksmiths there would go to that shul. I'm not really sure why it worked that way. But again, someone with a greater historical background can let us know. Anyway,
the Art Scroll comment says it's because their work was unclean. So people didn't want to mingle. I don't know, their clothes were dirty, they smelled, whatever, but it had to do with the unclean nature of their work.
Thank you, Rabbi Arthur Scroll. I wish I could take credit for that. It's not me. Okay, I see. So it's classism, basically.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we know they had classism back then. Okay. Okay. So anyway, that detail doesn't really is kind of insignificant for the general point here. So Shai Rishalayim Shemachur Rabbi Eliezer, they sold it to Rabbi Eliezer. Basaba Kol Tzrachav, and he used it for whatever he wanted to use it for. So, how are they allowed to sell a city and urban shul? It's the answer. Vahasam de Krachim Hava, right? It was in the city. You're not allowed to sell an urban shul. So the answer is, Ahibe Knishka Zuti Hava Inhu Avdua. This is like, if you go, let's say on the Upper West Side, so there'll be a shul, let's say like Lincoln Square Synagogue, which is like a huge community shul. But also, I don't remember the names, but there'll be like little shtiblach here and there on the Upper West Side as well. So those little shtiblach are clearly not established as, you know, I'm sure they'll welcome anyone who wants to join them, but they're established based on a certain interest group. They're not established as a communal shul. So therefore, they have the right to sell it if it's an interest of their particular group, which it's made to serve. All right. That was a shorter one. This one's a little bit longer, and it's actually going to get us into a little bit to the question of splitting up the Beis HaMikdash / Yerushalayim. So this should be fun. Mesve, another challenge to the principle that you cannot sell an urban shul. So this is talking about tsaras. There's something called a bais hamenuga, which tsaras can, you know, you could get tsaras on yourself, you get tsaras on your clothing. In theory, you could get tsaras also on your house. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that that never actually happened, but anyway. So the thing is, tsaras will only ever happen the base Eretz Achuzaskan, in a house that is found in Eretz Yisrael, in your land. Not only does that exclude the diaspora, but it also excludes the city of Jerusalem as well from ever being susceptible to the buildings contracting tsaras. So that's the Tanna Kamma. The second opinion, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Ani lo shemati ela makom mikdash bilvad. I only know, my tradition is that the only place that was impervious to tsaras was the Beis HaMikdash, and the Gemara is assuming why? Because the Beis HaMikdash is a public area. But this would seem to indicate that anything other than the Beis HaMikdash, i.e. shuls and Batei Midrashim, those places are susceptible to tsaras because they are private buildings. Wait a minute. I thought the whole reason you can't sell a shul in an urban area is because they're public buildings. But Rabbi Yehuda seems to be telling us that they're private buildings. So how do I reconcile this? So the answer is, Ema Rabbi Yehuda, ani lo shamati ila makom mekudash bilvan. You got to stick a vav in over there. What did Rabbi Yehuda actually say? Rabbi Yehuda said, anywhere in Jerusalem, even in Jerusalem, is going to be susceptible to tsaras, except for sanctified places, like the Beis HaMikdash, and like the shuls and batei midrashos, because those places are public places. So therefore, they're not susceptible. So we can still maintain that shuls, urban shuls, are generally by default considered communal shuls. Okay. Now that we brought up this machlokes tangentially, we're going to delve a little deeper into it. B'mai kemifligi, what is the Tana Kama and Rabbi Yehuda arguing about? So remember, the Tana Kama says that achuzasim mitami b'negayim ve'ein yushalayim mitami b'negayim, that Yerushalayim is not susceptible. So why would Yerushalayim not be susceptible to negayim? Tanakama savar lotus chalk Yerushalayim l'shvatim, because he actually believes that Jerusalem was not allotted, or at least down the line, was not allotted to the different shvatim. Jerusalem as a whole is considered to be public territory. Essentially, once King David took it over and established it as a Jewish capital, anyone who was living in there, we're going to see in a moment, it's a mix between Shevet Yehuda and Shevet Binyamin, to a certain degree, it became public. Now, what does that mean? It's public. Like, my house becomes public property now. We're going to see actually at toward the end of the Gemara that to a certain degree, when people are making pilgrimages to come up for the Shalosh Ragam, the three holidays, they can actually lodge at people's inns and they don't have to pay for staying there. It's kind of like, I feel like we had like a whole American Revolution about something like that. with soldiers being forced into people's homes. So anyway, we're going to talk about that momentarily. Rehuda Savar, Nischalki Yerushalayim L'Shvatim. Rehuda, however, holds that Yerushalayim was divided amongst the tribes. And actually, the Plutu D'Hai Tanai, their machlokis is also a machlokis found between two different brisos, two different Tanyanic passages. D'Tanya, this brisa over here, we're going to go through the brisa and in a little bit of a, not convoluted, but in a indirect way, supports Rabbi Yehuda's position. So remember, in Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount actually is split between the tribe of Yehuda and the tribe of Binyamin's territory. So, what was considered within the territory of Yehuda? Har Habayis, Halishkos Vazaros, Umahai Bechagosha Binyamin. So Yehuda on Har Habayis, he gets the different chambers, the courtyards, but Binyamin, he actually gets where the Beis HaMikdash itself stands, as well as the Ulam is that first room, the Heichal is the sanctuary, and the Kodesh Kedoshim is the inner sanctum. And what happened was, Urtsua Haisa Yotzes Mechelkosh Yehuda, Binyamin Mechelkosh Binyamin. There was like a strip of the area of the land that went through, and that was considered Yehuda's. And basically, I think I have a picture of my computer. I wouldn't be surprised if the ark is folded.
Oldest.
Here it is. I don't know if you could see this well. You could basically see where those lines are, that there is a section of the altar, the Mizbeach, that most of it is Binyamin, but you see like gray area over here. So this gray area is Yehuda's. So Yehuda's territory actually takes a slither away from Binyamin where the Mizbeach would stand. So Binyamin is not really happy about that. And Binyamin would be pleading with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was in agony every single day that, that one little bit of land, if only the entire Mizbeach was built upon my portion. Therefore, God rewards Binyamin by making him like Ushbizim, right? So he gets to accompany the Shekhinah. Now, what does that mean? If you look at Rashi, Shaya Aron Bechelko, that the Ark of the Covenant would be within his portion. So even though he didn't get the entire altar, he still gets a pretty good deal at the end of the day. Anyway, all of this is to say, we clearly see that Jerusalem was divided between different tribes. Because otherwise, where do we get this whole entire story about Yehuda getting land that Binyamin wanted? Clearly we see even the Beis HaMikdash itself has a division between two tribes. So there we go. However, we have a brisa that suggests the other way, that Yerushalayim was public territory and did not belong to any specific sheva. So this is talking about when people come up for the pilgrimage festivals, the Shalosh Regalim, and now you're coming up, you need a place to stay, right? So Emaskir and Batim b'Yerushalayim, you can Mipnei Inan Shalahem. People who have lodging areas are not allowed to rent and make a profit off lodging pilgrims coming up. Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok Omer, aflo mitos. You can't even charge them for the beds that they're sleeping on. Lefikach, therefore, you know what they would do? Oros kachim bali ushpiz and notlin osam bezroa. So the people who own these lodging these lodges, they would actually, so you bring your karbanos, the people coming, they would bring their offerings, and then they get to take some of the meat, and they get to take some of the hide back. So the people who were hosting them against their will, they said, well, the least you can do is give me a little bit of that offering. So they took their hides from them by force. And interestingly, it wasn't, you should note the language over here. I didn't get to look too deeply into it. But it doesn't say that Beis Din would go ahead and extract it for them. So they didn't technically have a full legal right to it, but it seems that the Beis Din at least would turn a blind eye to this practice because they understood that, hey, you know, this guy's being, he's forcing himself and squatting in your place. The least he could do is give you something. And in fact, actually, Amar Abaye teaches us that it's Derech Eretz to bring a hostess gift. Shmamina orach ar the mishpach inish gufo mashkabush bize. You should bring, you know, bring a jug of wine. You should bring or some hides. But you know, when you go somewhere and someone's putting you up, you're supposed to bring a host gift. So we can see that it was Derech Eretz back then as well. Some good practical lessons from the Gemara.
You know what this all makes me think of a little bit? It's like, in cities, like even in our own city, we have places where there's historic designation. All right, that might not be the right term. I can't remember the term now, but like where, because of the important status of a building, if you buy the build, you can buy the building, but you can't change it. You can't, you know, you're restricted in what you can do with it because of its historic designation. This is a little bit with Yerushalayim. It's like the status.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Right. It's like they're like heritage sites. So like, it's not.
There's a special term for it. It's like, never want your house to be designated like that because it restricts what you can do.
Right. Right. It's like, you're like not even the owner. You just have a right to utilize it, but you're not the owner of the place per se. I'm not sure how legally, but you're referring to how they would conceptualize.
Yeah. No, you're the owner, but you just can't do with it what you want.
Right. Oh, I see. I mean, that's like living in a some like gated communities. You know, they have what's that called? The housing committee. No, that's not the right word.
Someone help me. Condominium association.
Yeah, whatever it is, something like that.
A gated association.
Thank you, Jen. There you go. That's what I was looking for. Right, the whole reason you can't paint your house green or whatever.
Right.
I should be Zocha one day, but apparently that's how it works in some places. Okay. Final part, Zadie. This is the part that that we've been waiting for. Okay. This is what you were referring to. After all is said and done, about when can you sell a shul? When can't you sell a shul? What can you use the proceeds for? The truth is, all these halachos rarely apply because of the following built-in exception to the rule. So this is kind of, I don't want to say it makes everything we just did irrelevant, but you're about to see why one might think that. Amarava, lo shanu elishlo machu shiva tobi ha'ir b'mamad anshir. Everything we just talked about, all the limitations on selling a shul, is when you can't get 7 of the officials of the city in the presence of the city to sell it. However, alvo machu shiva tobi ha'ir, You get the seven, I'm translating as dignitaries for lack of a better term. You know, give me, what's the official art scroll translation of?
Trustees.
Trustees, thank you. So if you get seven trustees together, the Mamet Achiyair, and they do this in the presence of the town. It's not some backdoor operation. It's being done publicly and transparently. A feel of Mishta Bay Shikra Shapra Dami. You can use the proceeds. Forget about, you know, whether you can use it to get another shul or what in the shul. Can I buy Sfarim with it? You can use it to buy beer and, you know, anything you basically want for it afterwards. And by the way, if you look at Rashi, just back on the Chav Vav of an Aleph, Rashi says, Haka Kedusha min ha-chefet u-min ha-damet, that the Kedusha dissipates both from the object, from the shul itself, and from the proceeds of it. But Mutter Lassami and Kolritzam, you can do whatever you want with them. Generally, a good model for this paradigm comes up with Meiser Sheni. So Meiser Sheni, you need to bring down to your Shalayim, but you're going to bring all that food down to Jerusalem to eat it there? That's really difficult. So what you can do is you can be poved to it. You can transfer the Kedusha from the food onto money, bring the money down to your Shalayim, and purchase food in your Shalayim with that money, but transfers the Kedusha from food to money to food. So the Kedusha has to go somewhere. What's interesting over here is that if you sell under these conditions, neither the money nor the building wind up being kadosh in the end. You can completely revoke it altogether. I just want to go a few lines in where there's a story about this, and then I want to give a little bit of elucidation why it works out. Rabina Havale Ahu Tila Debe Knishta. So Rabina, on a plot of land that he had, there was ruins, basically like a mound of ruins from an old shul. And so clearly not operational in any way. Also, the commander of Ashi, Amarle, Mahu Mizrai, can I plant where this old shul once stood? Amarle, Zil Zag Mishu Tobe Ir, Bamad Ashi Ir of Zara. You can go ahead, get seven trustees from the city, have them sell in the presence of the city to you, make it an official transaction, and then you could go ahead and do with the plot of land whatever you wish. So the question is, if something has Kedusha, it has Kedusha. You know, where in Halacha do we come up with this whole idea that if you get, you know, imagine like we get seven trustees from the city together, and in the presence of the whole city, we are now declaring that, you know, I don't know, what sin do we want to revoke today, guys? What avir do we want to revoke? Give me one. Don't say pork. That's too basic. Okay, whatever it is. We want to revoke. We want to revoke second day Yom Tov, right? We want to get rid of Yom Tov Shane Shalgamios.
Right.
We're going to get seven trustees. We'll get our executive committee together. I don't know if there's seven. I'm sure it's roughly seven. We'll get the board members together. We'll get the rabbi. We'll do it in the presence. Everyone will, you know, if there's one way to get everyone into shul to fill up the sanctuary, this is the way we do it, right? Everyone's going to fill up the sanctuary. And we're going to say, we hereby are revoking the second day of Yom Tov. And everyone will be celebrating. You'll never see, you know, it's like my best sermon that I ever gave at shul that got the biggest applause was when I got up there and said, I'm not giving a sermon today. So it's the same logic. Where did we come up with this whole idea, Halakha, that you get seven trustees together and then they can revoke Kedusha from somewhere? It sounds very odd. To which our good friend, the Birchas Avram, bring him back in, he says, this is why it's a pretty clear proof that there's no Kedusha on a De'oraisa level here. Any sanctity we're talking about here is rabbinically mandated for the synagogue. Why? Now, there is, by the way, a sheet that the Chafetz Chaim believes that even synagogues have biblical level sanctity. It says, Mikdashai Tirao, just like the Beis HaMikdash has sanctity, so too biblically shuls have sanctity. However, it would seem that we'd have to suggest that shuls have rabbinical level sanctity. Now, what's the difference for biblical or rabbinical? Because on a biblical level, there's no such mechanism that we see that you get seven trustees together to revoke something. It has to be rabbinically mandated because we have the age-old principle of hey mamru fe hey mamru. As my rabbinic mentor, my Ellie Weissman, from when I was an intern, as he would say, the rabbis giveth, the rabbis taketh. So the same rabbis who imposed Kedusha on something that doesn't have Kedusha can also create their own mechanism for when we can revoke the Kedusha that they imposed to begin with. So if the rabbis were the ones who imposed all these limitations on if and how and when you can sell a shul, they could also have the right to build in whatever exception to the rule they want as well. And here's the thing. I understand mechanically why that makes sense. But what's the logic still? Again, you know, the rabbis generally ordain, they institute things, they implement them, ka'in de'oraisa. They try to emulate biblical mechanisms. So why are they making up a new mechanism over here? What's really going on? To which the Birchas Avram beautifully answers that what kind of kedusha are we dealing with when we talk about a shul? There's a different kind of kedusha coming from a Torah versus a shul. Torah, Sifrei Torah, they have inherent kedusha. But when it comes to a shul, a shul's kedusha is more analogous to, let's say, a sukkah and lulav, which are tashmishe mitzvah. They are items that are utilized for mitzvah. They don't have inherent kedusha, which is why, by the way, over the course of sukkahs, you cannot use a lulav for your own personal needs. For instance, in theory, actually, even like you're not supposed to be benefiting from the smell of the hadassim, because the hadassim are huksa lemitzvah. They are designated exclusively for mitzvah purposes. You're not supposed to be using even, there are a number of books. Va'od, hishu sham lenoisu, you're not supposed to stop being medical shiva. You're not supposed to be making use of even the decorations in the sukkah over the course of sukkahs. But what happens after sukkahs is over? What do you do with your lulav? How do you get rid of it? In theory, I mean, this is what I'll tell you what I did. I took my lulav, I took my aravos, I took my agasin, and I put it nicely and gently by a tree in a bush in the tall grass, and I let it return back to the earth from whence it came, right? Biodegradable. So why am I allowed to do that? Because when it comes to tashmishi mitzvah, when they are no longer used for that mitzvah, their time is up, their kedusha dissipates as well. Now, we try to still put them away respectfully. We shouldn't be mevazeh. We shouldn't go ahead and denigrate these things that were once upon a time used for mitzvah, but they don't retain their kedusha afterwards. Whereas a safer Torah, we could say, we have all these Torahs that are dedicated to shul. We have a huge ark filled full of Sifrei Torah. You know, a lot of those are actually puzzle, but it's another discussion. We could say that we don't need some of these Sifrei Torah anymore. We never plan on using them. It doesn't matter. If it's a safer Torah, it has kedusha, whether anyone ever intends to take it out or not. It's inherently kadosh. So what's going on here with the Beis HaKnesses? The shul has a status of tashmishei kedusha. So what he says, b'chol zman shebnei ha'ir rotzim bo can be surah. So let's apply the same principles we applied to Luv and Esrim. So long as people plan on using this building for the purpose of performing a mitzvah, it retains its kedusha as tashmishei mitzvah. It cannot be used for anything else other than what a Beis HaKnesses can be used for. However, once we decide that we no longer want to use this building for mitzvahs anymore, it loses its kedusha, just like the Arba Minim, once Sukkot is over, it no longer has any purpose any longer, and so the kedusha dissipates. Now, note, he says, Eno Bizoy, you can actually use the building for whatever you want. Generally, we try to use things that were once upon a time used for mitzvah, tashmishi mitzvah. We try to discard them in a respectful manner. But he's saying, the Iker Hadin, you can actually use it for whatever you want. To which, coming back to these cases of a shul being used and the funds being used, I don't know, the shul's being used now for some other purpose completely that has nothing to do with Kedusha. If it was sold by the trustees, which I'm sure you have to get the trustees together, and they did things the right way, it may be sad, but the building actually could be used for other purposes, and the funds could be used for other purposes. Now, what should they be used for? I mean, I'm not on that committee, so I'm not going to tell you, but this would seem to be the halacha based on his analysis. So hopefully this gives a little bit more of an insight into the nature of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses.
Yeah. So Rabbi, so I assume then none of this would apply, for example, to the site of the Beis HaMikdash.
So the difference in the Beis HaMikdash, I would say, is that it's God's house.
So. Right. So then how do the trustees of Yerushalayim have the right to allow a Muslim temple to be there?
Who said they do have the right?
Okay. No. Yeah. Maybe they don't.
Who said all decisions in Israel are based on halacha? Halavai. You know, God willing, one day. But I'm willing to say unequivocally that the Torah would prefer that the Beis HaMikdash was there as opposed to a mosque. I would think that's what the Torah wants. Now I'm not giving any practical guidance though on what to do with this current situation. It's not my place. All right.
Back to the sale of a shul though. So to make it like really kosher, let's say, you know, you're going to contract, you're going to sell the shul. I mean, these things don't just happen like that. By right, should you be emptying out the shul from its contents before you even go to contract?
Why? Oh, you're saying because you still plan on using it for Kedusha.
Right.
You're obligating yourself to sell it when you go to contract.
Right. So my understanding is that this would be not a symbolic act. It still needs to be a monetary transaction done with kinyanim, I presume. But the difference here is like, look at the case, for instance, that we just ended the Gemara in which, who was it? It was Rabina. He already owned the field, but then he was advised that, but then I'm sure he paid like $1 to get the field from the trustees of the city. So I would imagine you could kind of go through the legal process of selling and then do this more. Again, it's still from a Jewish standpoint, this is a real monetary transaction, but the transaction could be $1 for all we care in order to effectuate this kind of kinyan. But thank God I haven't had to be involved in such a process before. I'm sure there's certainly many more details to consider that I did not look up for the purpose of our shiur. But it's certainly something worth looking into, hopefully just from a theoretical standpoint. All right. Shkayach, everyone. Thank you for logging on. Wonderful learning together and wishing you all a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.